From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Our understanding of autism has changed since that word was first used for a diagnosis in the 1940s. In fact, with all its mystery and complexity, our understanding of autism never seems to stop changing. At one time, there were only a handful of identified cases. Now, by one estimate, there are 500,000 Americans diagnosed with autism, one in 45 children. A new history helps us understand what can seem like an explosion. This hour on Point, how we've come to understand autism. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have your attitudes toward people with autism spectrum disorder changed over the years? How has your understanding evolved? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington are John Donvan and Carol Zucker, two journalists who've been covering autism for more than 15 years. Both have experience with autism in the family. They are co-authors of the big new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. John Donvan is an ABC News correspondent and moderator of Intelligence Squared U.S. debates on public radio. He's also been a guest host on this show. John, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here today.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be back, Tom.
And Karen Zucker is a journalist and television producer for ABC and PBS NewsHour and co-author of In a Different Key with John. Karen Zucker, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
There's so much to look at here. This is a very rich history. It's incredible to think that presumably this has been around all through human history, or for much of it, one form or another, and only in the last century did a kind of definition come to be put around it. I'd love to start with a couple of people who you describe in the book as important to the historical understanding. One has a name that we know very well, but I knew none of this history, Hans Asperger. John, Karen, can you introduce us to Hans Asperger and his kind of checkered, more than kind of checkered, history when it comes to understanding what this realm is all about?
Hans Asperger was a critical figure in the development of the notion of autism in that back in the 1930s, working in Vienna with children, mostly young boys, he noticed a tendency in boys who had a significant number of social challenges in their lives. They were picked on, they were bullied, they had a difficult time making friends, they also had a certain personality pattern that related in a couple of ways to one another with a consistency. They had difficulty making eye contact with people. They might have been had a tendency to focus on very, very narrow subjects that they liked to talk about almost exclusively. And Asperger looked at them and came up with the notion of what he called autistic psychopathy. It was a word he borrowed from schizophrenia, where autism was described as a symptom of schizophrenia. Well, he applied it to these boys and said that he felt that he was seeing something new in them. He also, interestingly, very important part of it, he said that for a lot of these boys, they were also gifted in many ways. They were superior with numbers. They were very good at analyzing systems. He even suggested that there was a kind of creativity in human history that depended on having these particular traits.
And of course, Asperger's, we know, and many of us know people who are in that realm today. Generally, this is a name we have positive associations with, but there is World War II history, Nazi history here, Karen Zucker, that in some ways speaks to centuries of trouble around this, wasn't even a diagnosis, but trouble around how people in this realm have been treated, and even Hans Asperger right in the middle of that, Karen.
Well, it was hard not to be right in the middle of it if you were living in Austria in that period of time. The Nazis were sending people to their deaths, and especially people with developmental disabilities and people who were different, people who they thought couldn't contribute to society. And Hans Asperger had a group of children that he was working with who were very high functioning. And to a certain extent, the history tells us he tried to protect them. And he did this very well. But there were also children that were more disabled that perhaps he knew he couldn't protect them. We don't really know because we can't say. But we do know that he had signed papers that ended up sending these children to the Spiegelgrund, which was a place that everyone in history now knows was a place where children went and never came out because they died there.
They were murdered.
It was described as a hospital in those days, but that was not its function.
It was essentially a killing facility. Children went there, and it was one last assessment under the Nazi program of euthanasia for extremely developmentally disabled and physically disabled children. It was the last sorting, and some children, yes, came out of there alive. But the ones who didn't, what happened was their meals were spiked with phenobarbital, or they were given phenobarbital in suppositories, so that over a matter of weeks, this overdose, essentially, of this drug would cause a failure in their lung function. And what would happen in the Nazis kept very good records. What would happen is that a notation would be made that the child had died of pneumonia. And, you know, the role of Asperger in this is highly controversial. It's been whispered about for some time, but what we report in the book is the work of a man named Hervik Cech, who is an Austrian historian, motivated in part, I think, by the fact that he discovered as a young man that his own grandfather had been a convinced Nazi. He has dedicated his career as an historian to examining and exploring the records of the Austrian medical profession, and often finding out that people did things that look very bad in retrospect. And he found, as Karen said, a document in particular in which he recommended sending this little girl named Herta Schreiber, who was 3 years old and had very, very serious brain insult. She was not functioning well, to the Spiegelgrund, and he documented that she went there. And within several weeks, on the day after she turned three, she died. And in the records, it says she died of pneumonia.
Is there any mystery or question that he knew what her fate would be there?
It's highly unlikely that he did not know what happened at the Spiegelgrund. Everybody knew what was happening at the Spiegelgrund. He was very much a part of the medical establishment. Now, as Karen said, we're not saying that this means that, number one, definitely doesn't mean that Asperger's work was not without merit. It has a lot of merit. It's been very influential. It also doesn't mean he was an evil man. He was not a member of the Nazi Party. But Hervik Cech has looked at it and found that in a lot of ways, Asperger went along and did what he had to do to survive, and also, though, to protect his career, because he kept moving up the ranks. So, no, he was not a Nazi in the sense of being a member of the Nazi Party. We don't even know if he agreed with them. We just know that when it's been often cited that he was something of a protector, that he was a hero, and that he protected all children. And unfortunately, it shocked us when we saw this. We believed that narrative ourselves. But when we saw this information, we just thought, you know, it would be wrong to hide it.
Yes.
Right, this isn't the heart of our book. But once we knew that information, if we didn't share it, we felt we wouldn't be doing our jobs as journalists.
Well, I found it fascinating because his name is still so present in our lives today, in a time of a much more subtle understanding of what's going on, because in many ways he's been lauded. But then there's this. And in some ways, here was a man trying to do the right thing, but up against Nazi policy. I mean, people have struggled, as you describe here, have struggled for years, for centuries, to try and do the right thing by people whose conditions just were not understood and were widely reviled.
Well, it happens again and again throughout the stories we tell in the book. Now, the better known story of autism outside of Asperger is that of a doctor named Leo Kanner. And Leo Kanner is the person whose papers on autism in the 1940s really established the diagnosis. The English-speaking world knew nothing about Hans Asperger for most of the last century. Leo Kanner was a superstar in psychiatry, and in 1938, a young boy in Mississippi named Donald was brought to Kanner's clinic in Baltimore. And the mother and father were a little bit beside themselves because Donald was not like any child they had ever seen before. He did not communicate in ways that they could understand. He said certain things over and over and over again. He did not ever cry for his mother or run to his father. And when somebody came in dressed up as Santa Claus, he ignored him completely. And they went to him thinking, and as the mother said, that he was hopelessly insane. But Kanner had a different opinion.
But what was interesting, before they got to Kanner, they did what most parents were told to do at that time in history, which was to send their child to an institution.
Send them away.
Send them away. And the triplets Mary Triplett, Donald's mother, his family owned a bank, and they had very high standing in the community. And when they couldn't figure out what to do with Donald, and they had looked around and they had met with many doctors, they sent him to a place for a year. And after the end of the year, they just thought they gave up too quick. They have to figure this out. They're not going to leave him there for his life. And his entire life would have been different if Mary hadn't decided, Marianne Beeman, his dad, to take him out.
In fact, there may not be an autism diagnosis as we know it today had they not pulled him out and gone to Baltimore. So Connor sees Donald and starts to see similar patterns in 10 other children. He and Mary start this correspondence that we've actually, our archival research, Karen, discovered the medical records that there was this correspondence between Mary Triplett, Donald's mother, and Leo Connor, in which Connor was explaining that he was trying to puzzle out what this was because he hadn't seen anything like it before.
We're talking case one, as you described Donald
case
Triplett
one.
There.
Yeah.
A man who goes on to live a long life, still alive there in Forest, Mississippi. Kind of beloved in the community, almost a Forrest Gump kind of picture. I want to ask you about that and much more, though that's not how it began. It's amazing, as you describe Leo Connor, back in the time when he had maybe 8 or 10 of these diagnoses. Today, we're looking at a number like 500,000 in this country. Your book helps us understand how that frame grew and changed. John Donvan, Karen Zucker, please stand by, co-authors of the new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the struggle to understand autism, from the first labeled case in the United States in the 1940s to the 500,000 diagnosed today on the spectrum, our constantly evolving understanding of autism. My guests are John Donvan and Karen Zucker, co-authors of the big new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. What's your question on how we came to understand this, at least to the point, the extent that we do today? And can you remember how cruel society could be before we had a diagnosis to give this, some shared understanding of it? Are we more compassionate, more insightful now? Do you have someone on the spectrum in your family? How does this story, the history of our understanding of autism, strike you? There's a lot to dig into, but also a lot of callers for the two of you. Anami in Charlotte, Vermont. Anami, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story?
Well, my story is not a reflection on autism, but on killing mentally disabled people. I knew a woman in Vienna whose father was the director of a mental hospital, and I truly don't know which one. He was ordered to kill patients, and he refused, and he was sent to the Eastern Front at a time when that was already a sure, a very likely death sentence. And in fact, he never did come back. So it's just a little tidbit of history that I'm throwing in there.
Anami, I appreciate your call. You know, John, Karen, in a way, it's a moment to pause in the forward history that you describe and look even deeper back. You remind us that when you put the template of autism as we understand it today up against the annals of history, it appears that it is speckled with people who may have been exactly in this realm. When we look back deep in history, what do we see, John Karen? What can we tell? We're so attuned to it today. What about in the past? Who might have had it? How was it described? How was it seen? Were there patterns seen, or was it all just one at a time?
We think autism has always been part of the human condition in people going way back. The problem is the idea didn't exist, the recognition didn't exist, and so there's nobody back before 1943 writing about autism, but efforts have been made to look at scant descriptions of, say, biographies of individuals. We found a very fascinating thing ourselves looking through a report that was published in Massachusetts in 1848 by the man who is famous as the founder of the Perkins School for the Blind, Samuel Howe. Mm-hmm. Howe was very, very interested and became interested in the 1840s in the condition of what were in the terminology of the day were called the state's idiots. And that was not meant as a reference. It was not meant as an insult. It was meant as a reference to what we would, with more sensitivity today, call intellectual disability. Mm-hmm. And he put together a team with funding from the state legislature to travel around the state and go village by village over a two-year period documenting data on all of these individuals who had been identified as fitting this category. And he published a report. And in the report, he acknowledged that there were many people who just had been – he had been told they were idiots, but they for some reason didn't quite, for various reasons, fit in.
Mm-hmm. Case number 27, Billy. He's 56 years old, and he had perfect pitch. Perfect pitch, we now know, is one of the characteristics that some people with autism have.
What year are we talking here, Karen, maybe?
1846.
Okay.
And he also did something which we didn't understand at the time. He would repeat things over and over again. He would say, someone would tell him to go milk the cows, and then Billy would say, Billy, go milk the cows. Billy, go milk the cows. Billy, go milk the cows. And he would do that over and over again. And we now know that that's called echolalia. Now, Billy could go milk the cows. It wasn't that he couldn't do that. It was this type of speech that he had that we can see in retrospect is a very, very – it's a kind of pattern that you see quite often in children with autism.
Can we have people gone back further even than that, further than the 19th century, and said, there's the profile, surely that's autism, or does it get too murky?
It's always going to be murky. Even any retrospective diagnosis has a bit of murkiness to it. But yes, there are intriguing hints that others have written about. Some scholars at the University of Michigan back in the 1960s proposed that a famous group of Russian saints who were known as the Holy Fools perhaps were actually manifesting autistic traits. And these were a group of individuals, St. Basil and others, who were known for wandering the countryside in very cold weather, almost naked. Now, being having a sensory insensitivity to cold or the reverse has often been yet another autistic trait, documented autistic trait. And they were speaking in what were considered socially inappropriate ways, especially they became famous and beloved by the Russians for saying insulting-sounding things to people who were powerful. And they had strange dietary, unusual dietary patterns, all of which, again, does this nail the fact that these people had autism? No, but it's a very, very intriguing hint that the traits that now are drawn under the umbrella of autism have been part of the human condition for a long, long time.
Fascinating. Because we worry today that we're in the midst of some kind of explosion, maybe with an environmental cause. And I want to come to that, but more callers for you first. Randy in Corydon, Indiana. Randy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for having me on. I was recently diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. I'm 61.
Okay.
Growing up, I went through a lot of testing, you know, trying to figure out what's going on with Randy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Had I not, you know, or had my parents not been told that, well, obviously he's got brain damage because this part of the brain just isn't working, but it didn't make sense that I could do math in, say, my science courses, but not in my math classes. In part because, you know, I had been getting slapped around by a teacher.
Because they didn't like your behavior. Do you feel, Randy, that over the course of your life, you say you're now diagnosed at 61 only a couple of years ago, is it getting easier because people's understanding is deepening?
Well, I don't know that it's getting any easier. I would certainly hope that people are becoming more attuned to it. You know, or informed, better informed. I know that from what I have read, people like Sir Henry Cavendish, you know, was a brilliant man, and the accounts from his colleagues pretty well describe him as having traits of autism. The book that I found interesting to read was Steve Silberman's Neuro Tribes.
Randy, yes. Were you bullied as a child and into your teen years?
Yes.
I mean, that's so much
I've been attacked with knives and baseball bats and so forth. Yeah, was I bullied as a kid? You bet. I learned to fight.
I mean, part.
I went on to college and graduated, you know, despite being told that, well, no, you know, by my school counselors and teachers, no, don't go bother with college. You know, you'll never become an engineer, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, part of the goal of our book is we're trying to reach the spectrum, the entire spectrum, so that people accept people who are different, no matter how small that is or how disabled somebody might be. Our goal is for people to understand and embrace someone like you and someone who can't even speak for themselves. And
Randy, I really appreciate your call. John Karen, let me put it to you this way. Here's Randy. He's 61. He's kind of grown up through the thick of the history that you describe. You can imagine the changes in the understanding, the social understanding of what this is all about. I mean, take us through the arc that he's had to live through, sometimes fighting knives and baseball bats and bullying, the sort of evolution of our understanding of the spectrum of autism, Asperger's, during Randy's lifetime. How would you describe it?
Well, you know, before Randy was diagnosed, the people that were diagnosed with autism really had very severe disabilities. And that's how we know that there is an autism spectrum today. We might not have recognized it if we didn't see the symptoms that were so extreme that parents would bring their children to get help. Unfortunately, somebody like Randy, they couldn't even figure out what it was.
And often parents would just be told by teachers, and it's interesting that Randy brings up a teacher problem. They would just be told by teachers, you need to find a way to control your kid better. And that's often an experience that autism parents had, that the society was very, very unsympathetic. So in Randy's lifetime, 60 years, that covers a very big chunk of the story, frankly. By the time he was born, the concept was only about 15 years old. As we said, people with the more severe variants, not Randy, the more severe variants were locked away in institutions. People like Randy were, Karen and I like to have sort of coined the term, they were swimming with the sharks because they were out in society. They were out in public school, but they were mercilessly treated and ridiculed and made to feel stupid when, in fact, often they were the opposite. And we tell a story about a young man in our book named Alex Plank who had remarkably similar situation with teachers. He was bullied mercilessly. And by the way, the good story is Alex is doing very, very well now. And
good.
He's a net entrepreneur and he's a script consultant in Hollywood. But as a child, he was picked on in school so badly that the principal put a lot of kids together in a room thinking that she was going to work something out. She had Alex and six of the kids picking on him sit in a room together and to talk it through. Well, at that point, Alex wasn't so good at talking things through. And what happened that the session turned into was an hour of six kids talking about why Alex was such a jerk. And it was extremely hurtful to him. And it's when his mom pulled him out of that school and got him to another place where, again, acceptance was the rule. It changed everything.
How did we get from Leo Connor's handful or dozen diagnosed into the bigger numbers and the wider understanding of what all this was about? How did it become part of the public discourse slowly?
Well, a woman named Lorna Wing, who is a psychiatrist from the UK, had a daughter with autism. And she refocused her work to focus completely on autism. And she came up with this term called the autism spectrum.
And what she did was she and a colleague named Judith Gould back in the 1970s got a list of all of the children in a borough of London called Camberwell, thousands of children who had one way or another some sort of sign of intellectual disability or developmental disability or autistic traits. And there was literally a register in the basement of a building, boxes and boxes full of files. And the two of them went through all of these files and sorted out which of the kids had some indication of something that might be in any way suggestive of autism, even if they'd never been given a full-blown diagnosis. And on nights and weekends, over a couple of years, they went door-to-door driving around this borough in London, staying up late into the night with families, drinking a lot of tea, taking notes, and taking histories, all of which they brought back and assembled into an enormous database. And by the way, they made the first use of punch card computers at the University of London. It was that early. And out of this, they constructed the idea of an autism spectrum, by which they said, let's broaden the idea of what we mean by autism to count people who would be near misses, let's say, for the diagnosis in its more classic sense. And this was what opened the door to bringing in, for example, the idea of Asperger's syndrome to be part of the autism spectrum. And Lorna Wing's motivation in this was because she herself had a child with autism and knew how badly families needed support, and she wanted to, getting a diagnosis makes a big difference.
And what's interesting is, what's interesting is that Lorna's daughter was very, very disabled. But as a parent, she knew it didn't matter where your child fell on the spectrum, that if you had a child with any form of autism, that you needed support. You needed support of the community. You needed support of services. You needed to be able to get them educated. And she saw this even not living that experience, but just being close enough to autism to know that anybody who was struggling with that should be under that same umbrella.
So they tracked so many that they needed computer punch cards to do it. But here's my question, and I see a lot of this coming from our listeners. You know, so that's many, many stories, and it amounts to a spectrum. But is there a definition that really is firmly applied to this, or is it still an amorphous understanding? Here's one listener says, let me know when autism can be reasonably defined. Until then, I just don't get it.
I got to say, that is the question of our book. What are we talking about when we say autism? The reality is that nobody has really ever agreed to this. The definition has been revised countless times, and it really affects the whole question of figuring out even if there is more autism than there used to be.
Half a million sounds like a big number compared to 10.
It depends on what we're counting. And back in 1966, interesting story we discovered about the first time anybody ever tried to count autism in a community. A man from South Africa named Victor Lotter moved to London to undertake a project in which he counted all of the children of a certain age group, three-year age range, to see what the prevalence rate of autism was in that. He sent out questionnaires to hundreds of schools, and he got back 97,000 responses, and he looked through all of these and narrowed it down to a short list of about 300 children who might have autism. Like Lorna Wing, 10 years later, he got in his car along with his wife, Grace, and they drove around to all of these homes so he could – and to a lot of mental institutions, by the way, at that period – to look at these kids one-on-one and figure out – how many of them had autism? Well, here's the roadblock he hit, is he didn't have a working definition. He turned to the textbooks and found that they were all over the place and that there were arguments about it, and he wasn't sure.
Are we close? Are there competing definitions, or there is none?
There are many, many competing definitions.
And they continue to change.
And where this affected Lotter, in the end, this is historically significant because he came up with the first rate of autism, quote-unquote. It was 4.5 per 10,000 in the population. Well, he himself admits that it was entirely arbitrary. It depended on what he decided, what he himself decided to use as a definition. The interesting thing, though, is that that rate of 4.5 per 10,000 is still cited today as the rate of what autism used to be. Well, it used to be 4.5 in 10,000. Now look at it. Well, even that 4.5 in 10,000 is a quite arbitrary number, which Victor Lotter himself was honest enough to
admit. Are we still wandering in the dark then, or do we
It depends how you see it. If you see autism as a broad spectrum and you're on it somewhere, I think there's comfort in being part of that and being part of there's a thread, you know, that starts at one end and on the other.
But you say parents have two goals. Parents of those with autism, they want to find out why the children have it, and they want to make it go away. If you can't define it, it's hard to do either of those.
Well, again, that's why I think the caller made a terrific point. And by the way, not all parents want it to go away. I mean, there is an increasing tendency among parents to accept their children as they are, and that's a very, very powerful impulse.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Hi, it's Tom. With a quick heads up for you, be sure to stay with us to the end of this podcast for a sneak preview of Modern Love. It's WBUR's new podcast put together in collaboration with the New York Times. You may want to check it out. Thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with John Donvan and Karen Zucker, co-authors of the new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, about the struggle to understand autism over many years, from the first labeled case in the 1940s to the 500,000 diagnosed today, this constantly understanding of evolving understanding of what it is we're dealing with here. You can join us. What's your question on how we have come to understand autism? In just a moment, we'll talk with a researcher joining us from California today who's looking at boys and girls, gender differences in the brain and beyond. Call us first, Michael in Arlington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. 1 in 45 is a remarkably high number. Now, I know some people will say, oh, well, we just discover it earlier now and are able to label it, however vague the labeling is, better now. I don't quite believe that. Unfounded opinion by facts, but just my opinion. It seems to me it could be from, more likely is from, the growth is not just recognition, but incident. I wondered whether the researchers have done a incident map of both populations and geographic areas, just like there are cancer maps, which are scary things in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They always look like the aquifers are. And also, have they charted the growth? Now, I know because of the vagary of the term, it's hard to do. And if they looked at damaged DNA, so...
Michael, let us pick those up. They both kind of speak, as if I read you right, to the suggestion of an environmental cause. John, Karen, what about, are there incident maps out there? And what about the skepticism from our caller that this is just a matter of more diagnosis?
He's skeptical about the notion of more diagnosis. And there is, of course, that skepticism has been out there for a long time. The reality is, though, that social scientists who we don't think particularly have any motive not to be honest and intellectually honest, really do think this, that probably the majority of the perception of an increase, as the caller mentioned, the number going up to 1 in 45 by the CDC's last report back in November, that probably most of it is explained away by social factors such as increased recognition, the fact that people are looking for it. That might leave some portion of the increase unexplained, and nobody's ruling out entirely environmental factors. No, it's not being ruled out. It's just that it's still quite difficult thing to nail down.
Paul, and we also, I'm sorry, I was just going to add that we keep changing the definition. And in the changing of the definition, the numbers keep changing. And we're not counting the same thing. Mm-hmm. We keep changing what we're counting. And so it's very hard to keep track of.
And when you look closely at these numbers, 1 in 45, when the CDC put this number out, they said, by the way we got this number is we called up a bunch of parents and asked them if their child had ever had an autism diagnosis. And in the very report where that statistic was first filed, the CDC said, this is really not very reliable. Parents' memories are not necessarily the best, and we don't know who the doctors were who saw these people. It's kind of another best guess. And even the CDC said that they would still recommend that people, if they need a figure to cite, use the previously cited figure of 1 in 68. So the problem with going into these numbers is that it really is, because of the definitional problems, a matter of apples and oranges, and they can't in themselves be looked at as evidence of an increase in incidence.
Talk about a fog even now. Paul in Columbia, Missouri. Paul, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you talk about and I hear the statistics about the people, children affected by autism, be it 1 in 45 or, if you want to, you know, whatever you want to use, 1 in 145, to me that just is very disturbing. It causes alarms to go off in my head. And it just got me, you know, doing some personal research on it and doing a lot of thinking about it. And, you know, I'm just old enough to remember the generation that was affected by polio. And I don't know what caused me to draw a parallel between the two. But, you know, I remember seeing people who were physically disabled by polio and hearing their mothers talk about, you know, that experience and how it's, you know, if a kid got polio in a neighborhood, it just struck terror through that neighborhood, through that community. And what were the statistics of children affected by polio? It was one in 1,500 or something, far less than, you know, while the disabilities of polio were physical, in a way, I find the disabilities of autism far more alarming, in that the disabilities are mental, and to me that is far more serious. So, you've talked about, you know, the perceived explosion. Am I wrong to have that perception and be so alarmed about it, or maybe has our society today failed to react to it? You know, like they did with polio.
We've got it, Paul. This is a great question. I want to take it, if I may. Karen, John, please stand by. Let me take it to someone who's right out there on the frontier of research with autism. Christine Wu Nordahl joins us, assistant professor, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at UC Davis, the Mind Institute there. Her research focuses on understanding the neural basis for autism spectrum disorders. Christine Wu Nordahl, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Very glad to be here.
I want to look at a couple of the details of your research, but first to our caller's question there. How do you feel about, as a scientist who's right in the midst of this, are we too alarmed or insufficiently alarmed about what looks like, can look like, an explosion in prevalence of autism?
Well, the way I look at it is that greater awareness is a good thing. And, you know, whether there is a lot of dispute in the field as to whether the incidence is actually increasing or whether there's just more awareness and more diagnosis now. What we as researchers are faced with is now this incredible spectrum of this disorder, and it's incredibly heterogeneous. And so, you know, there's this saying, if you've seen one child with autism, you've seen one child with autism. And that goes both behaviorally and medically, I think. There are children with autism who have epilepsy, who have comorbid medical problems, GI problems, immune problems, and we're lumping them all together into this group called autism, which is a fine place to start.
Let's take a couple of big lumps here. You've been trying to figure out why there are fewer girls with autism than boys, kind of 4-to-1 boys to girls. What have you learned when you compare?
Well, that really came from this bigger study looking at this heterogeneity of autism. We were trying to look at different subgroups of autism, biological subgroups of autism, with the idea and the goal that maybe these different groups have different etiologies and might require different interventions.
When you say etiology, let's define that for our lay listeners.
A cause of autism, or what's going on biologically. I think, you know, going back to the earlier discussion about what is autism and is it increasing, one of the things that we face in the field is that it's behaviorally diagnosed right now. There is no biomarker for autism. There's no blood test that tells you if somebody has autism. And so it's kind of a fuzzy line there.
You did a lot of MRI imaging of males and females, boys and girls. What did you find neurologically?
So where I really got interested is I think that girls are a subgroup of autism. They're a distinct biological subgroup of autism. We know that boys and girls are different. We know that their brains are different. And so there's no real reason to think that boys and girls with autism are going to be the same. And I really got interested in this as an MRI researcher looking at the neural basis of autism, is that, you know, a lot of the findings that we think about when we think of the neuropathology of autism, one of the hallmark findings is this notion that kids with autism have bigger brains or bigger heads, macrocephaly. Mm-hmm. Even Lee O'Connor in his original publication noted that physically they were normal, but some had larger heads. And so when I started studying autism about 10 years ago, the first finding we tried to replicate was this notion of bigger heads in autism. And what I found is that, you know, over and over I could see this in the boys, in a subgroup of the boys with autism, but I didn't see it at all in the girls. And that was my first clue that there was something different about girls' brains with autism than boys.
What did you see in the images?
The girls absolutely had the same brain volumes. Girls with autism had the same brain volumes as typically developing girls, whereas boys with autism had about, on average, 6% larger brains than boys with autism. And a subgroup, about 15% of boys had very much larger brains than other boys typically develop.
So when you say girls are a distinct subgroup of autism, what does that mean? Again, in layperson's terms, does that mean it's a different problem or it's a different version of the same thing?
It's probably a different version of the same thing. So they behaviorally, their diagnosis is about the same. So right now in the field, there's a lot of interest in trying to understand why there is this difference, why there are four times as many boys diagnosed with autism as girls, and then also to answer the question, is autism actually different in boys than it is in girls? And some of the behavioral studies early on in the days of Lorna Wing first suggested that girls were more severely affected or had more rates of intellectual disability. But more recent studies using our current diagnostic standards suggest that the differences are more subtle. And it kind of makes sense because if you use the same diagnostic criteria, you know, they have to reach this sort of threshold to get a diagnosis of autism. And so there's not that many behavioral differences between boys and girls with autism as they're being diagnosed today.
Though you said girls may be better at camouflaging their autism symptoms.
Yes. And so one of the things that is currently on the forefront of research is trying to figure out if the diagnostic criteria we're using are actually good or accurate in diagnosing girls. There's this idea that girls may be going underdiagnosed, particularly higher functioning girls with autism. Some studies have shown that girls tend to be older when they're diagnosed, and often when they are diagnosed, they have more cognitive deficits or other problem behaviors that will sort of flag somebody's alertness to their problems, even though their social impairments are on the same level. And so, you know, historically, because there are so many more boys than girls with autism, the diagnostic criteria were really developed based on boys. And there's a thought right now that maybe some of the higher functioning girls are going underdiagnosed. Maybe they're better at camouflaging their symptoms or masking their symptoms, particularly in these structured clinical assessments where we're diagnosing autism.
Or learning to cope, another way of putting that, I guess.
Exactly, adapting or compensating, figuring out in social mm-hmm. situations, okay, I have to do this, mm-hmm. Act a certain way instead of another way. And then girls with autism and women with autism often have more anxiety and depression, maybe from the stresses of having to mask their symptoms.
Christine Wu Nordahl, we're glad you're out there on the frontier looking at it all, and we appreciate your joining us for a couple of minutes today from the UC Davis Mind Institute. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One more call for you, John, Karen, Aaron in Nashville, Tennessee. Aaron, you're on.
Hi, thanks for having your show.
Yeah.
I have a 7-year-old son with autism, and I just wanted to point out that many parents have come to a greater awareness and acceptance of children and really adults with autism. One of my greatest resources was talking with adults with autism and just learning to accept. And honestly, I would not, if I could turn a magic switch and change my son, I wouldn't. There's no way. There are certainly challenges with raising a child with autism, but I wouldn't change him because he would be a different child.
Aaron, I'm so glad for your call. John, Karen, it's a big movement, this movement of acceptance. At the same time, some with severe symptoms, see how their children may struggle with those and worry about how they will get by in adulthood. I mean, the acceptance that Aaron talks about has gone a long way toward, I think, reducing the cruelty, by no means gone, but reduced. But what about this? Another spectrum, accept or fight.
It's absolutely accept. In the big picture, in this sense, we mean that. And back in the 60s and the 70s, when parents were fighting to open schools and fighting to close down institutions, what their goal was to get their kids a place in the world. And that, that actual moment in time is playing out constantly. And we tell a story near the end of our book where there's a young man on a bus who has autism riding alone, and he starts to sort of make some noises that mm-hmm. are not language, and he's rocking and he's flipping his fingers. And sitting behind him are two men who start picking on him. They start going at him, and they say to him, hey, man, what's your problem? Why don't you cut it out? What's going on with you?
And then all of a sudden, this other passenger stands up and starts to shout at these guys and say, hey, he's got autism. What's up with you? You're the one who has a problem.
And you could feel in that moment from the person who described it to us that the whole bus lined up behind that young man. And so in our view, what happened on that bus is the beginning and the end of the story and where things need to go. So those two guys on the bus, they were the jerks. Our story tells
a story. That's a change. That's a huge change.
Very big change.
I mean, they were always, but they were never called out in the past you described. Now, there they
were. Exactly. And that's the acceptance that parents and individuals who are on the spectrum have fought for 70 years, and they're getting it, and they need much more of that, but we have a long way to go.
What does the future look like? Does it look like finding a cure of some sort, or does it look like us seeing this as just part of the human spectrum and embracing?
The future is about embracing, and it's about embracing the next generation, which is now the adults that are coming into, you know, all of these children grow up and they become adults. And in all if we can just accept people who are different, you didn't know adults 50 years ago because they were in institutions. This woman's son wasn't allowed to go to school. The fact that we have the problems that we have today about acceptance is because there's so many unsung heroes, so many parents, so many researchers who fought to get kids to where they are today.
What about a caller who says, look, we fought to cure polio just because this is the brain. Why shouldn't we stand up and do it here as well?
Because cure is a very, very complicated issue, and it depends on the individual's point of view. There are lots of people, as that mom said. Mm-hmm. She does not want to change who her son is. There are other parents whose children are so severely, or their lives are so limited by some of the autistic traits to the point where they're banging their heads and breaking their heads open. They do want to change that. They're not saying they want to cure that. They want to stop those things that limit their kids.
It's a remarkable story, and a story that moves in a good direction, but still many mysteries here, and an evolving definition itself of what autism means. John Donvan and Karen Zucker have written it up in great, rich detail in their new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. There's an excerpt at our website. Check it out, onpointradio.org. John and Karen, thank you very much for being with us, for all your work, and for being with us today.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
John Donvan, Karen Zucker, In a Different Key. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Caroline Bechtel and Maeve Pages. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Let's face it, when have you ever been in a relationship that's gone as planned?
Sometimes I think about the vows my wife and I made to each other 28 years ago, and we're different people than we once were.
And I don't even like him, I said, wiping my tears. He's a liar. I can't spend the rest of my life with him.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed sex injury.
Modern Love, popular New York Times column, is coming to you as a podcast.
There is no good way to tell a new guy in your life that you're going blind.
Between these two genteel southern ladies, our family became an old west town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them.
Starring some familiar voices.
Hey, this is Emmy Rossum.
Hi, this is Jason Alexander.
Hey, it's January Jones.
Hey, it's Judd Apatow here.
Modern Love will make you laugh.
Is everything all right up there?
It'll make you cry.
I started calling hospitals, then morgues.
It'll make you think.
We can't keep calling you daddy, he said, if you're gonna be a girl. It's too weird.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I'll be your host. Modern Love, the podcast, is a collaboration between the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
You're off the hook, I said. No guilt.
I love you. I love you too.
Modern Love, a new episode every Thursday. Subscribe today on iTunes and fall in love at first listen.